Welcome back to another episode of Télévision Éducative. Tonight, I'll show you how dreams are prepared. People think it's a very simple and easy process, but it's a bit more complicated than that.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to Breaking the Screen Spell, an Only in San Jose special that investigates and analyzes the impact of digital addiction and its prominence in society. My name is Deisha Huang, and I will be co-hosting with producer Alina Yin.
All right, Deisha, what were your takeaways from this conversation?
Some of my key takeaways were that some regulatory patterns we can see between the Netherlands or Europe in general and the United States, and also about our discussion on the use of artificial intelligence by companies, and just how Dr. Stryker sees the relationship between consumers and tech companies evolving in the future. And something that I found especially interesting was how companies are really personalizing their users and finding out their interests and personality. And one thing that stuck out to me was that they're able to get that data and information just from the content of your messages when you're texting someone.
Yeah, so that is definitely happening. And it's really like popular too among like coupon apps. I don't know if you use coupon apps.
I'm not sure what that is.
They're like grocery store apps, and you get points and coupons for whatever's on sale.
Oh.
Yeah, like the Whole Foods app or Safeway, and I don't know what other major store has it. I had a funny reaction re-listening to the interview. Because during the beginning, they mention doom scrolling a few times. And then I remember in one of our previous episodes, you didn't know what that was. And so I was just wondering if you remember in that moment what you were thinking when she kept saying doom scrolling.
Yeah, no, when you asked me that question, I honestly had no idea what that was. And same thing when I was in the interview. So I was sort of grasping at straws and looking at the context of what we were talking about to find out what that was. But now I do understand the term and have definitely experienced some instances where I was doom scrolling.
Okay. Do you have an emoji or word equivalent to our doom scroll?
Maybe the skull emoji, but I'm not sure if that's just using the context around it.
Okay. That's something to consider with, you know, multi-generational communication. And we're not even, you know, I don't think we're too far apart, but we are apart. And then the other thing that I was thinking about was when they started talking about how, for example, gender, women would be shown less tech opportunities and jobs. One of them was that because they didn't have these fraternity clubs on their CV that all the other previous men who mostly worked there had on their resume. And that's how like the algorithm impacted women in the job market. And you had asked a question about school in the academic, and we don't know, I think, the entire ramifications of that yet, but it just reminded me of, I feel that that's something that goes on right now, because the job market is kind of difficult right now.
Yeah, I was really interested in that part about how demographics can have such a large impact on what sorts of opportunities are available to youth or women or people of color, especially with that point you mentioned with just not being in a fraternity.
Yeah. For our TikTok break this episode, I think I'm going to go with Planet Earth. The Planet Earth one. Yes, me too.
I'm so over this planet. Are there any planets out there we can live on yet? Because this some bull. No, there are no planets out there that we can live on and that we can currently get to. And Mars totally sucks. It's cold, it's a desert, there's no water, you're bombarded by radiation that would give you cancer. It's just basically a cold, awful hellscape of a planet. And I love this place, I love Earth, and I'm here for life.
Today, we will be delving into how companies employ tactics that exploit human psychology to increase the time users spend on their platforms, and how this has led to addictive design that can negatively impact mental health. Digital technologies such as social networks, online shopping, and games use persuasive and motivational techniques to keep users returning. According to Phys.org, an online research news aggregator, in the pursuit of making their platforms more addictive, companies have employed persuasive techniques like scarcity, social proof, personalization, and reciprocity. Scarcity can be exemplified by a snap in Snapchat or status that is only temporarily available, encouraging you to get online quickly. Another example is Instagram stories, which are ephemeral content that makes users want to see the story before they disappear. Social proof is present in Twitter, where when thousands of users retweet an article, it motivates you to go online and read it as well. Personalization, such as in Pinterest or Instagram, is when your feed is designed to filter and display news or posts based on your interests. Finally, reciprocity encourages you to invite more friends to get extra points. And once your friends are a part of the network, it becomes much more difficult for either of you to leave. For example, a study by Cambridge refers to the popular app Snapchat. This app introduced Snapstreaks, a running tally of the number of consecutive days a user has exchanged photos, images, or snaps with another user, to take advantage of users' desire for social validation and reciprocity. Furthermore, if we focus on specific features, we witness things like push notifications, autoplay, pull to refresh, and infinite scroll, all of which are designed to increase the time spent by individual users. Social media platforms like Facebook, Twitter, and Snapchat are accused of offering unpredictable yet rewarding stimuli that encourage habitual use and social affirmation through feedback features such as the like button on Facebook. Push notifications are personalized alerts or messages that pop up on a user's device, even when they are not actively using the app. The goal is to draw users back to the platform by creating a sense of urgency and curiosity. While notifications can be useful in some contexts, excessive and constant notifications can lead to compulsive checking behavior and heightened anxiety, as users feel the need to respond immediately. The pull-to-refresh mechanism is used in smartphone apps like Twitter. It is a user interface design that allows users to update the content on their screens by pulling down and releasing. This action triggers the app to fetch new data, such as tweets or posts, providing users with the latest updates. The comparison between this mechanism and pulling the lever of a slot machine lies in the psychological principles that both leverage to create anticipation and excitement. Apps like Pinterest employ a clever design tactic known as infinite scrolling to keep users engaged and immersed in a continuous search for visual inspiration. When users scroll down the page, some images appear partially cut off or just barely visible below the browser's visible area. These partially revealed images pique the user's curiosity, enticing them to continue scrolling to discover the full picture. This design approach exploits the human tendency to seek novelty and engage in exploratory behaviors. In addition, Cambridge notes that prior to infinite scrolls, when a user arrived at the bottom of a web page, there is a natural stopping cue, that is, the end of the page. The user at that point would have faced some decisions, whether to press the link to load the next page, whether to exit the platform, and so on. Introducing infinite scrolls removed the opportunity to make such decisions. Because of these updates, as the user scrolls, the platform automatically generates the next page, thereby removing stopping cues that would have previously given the user the opportunity to reflect, even for a moment, on whether that user should continue using the platform. However, social media apps are not the only platforms that utilize addictive techniques to entertain users. Online shopping has become a very popular hobby for many internet users. Online stores such as Shein and Temu attract shoppers with their cheap prices, easy accessibility, personalized product advertisement, limited time deals, and wish lists. Online shopping sites use algorithms to analyze users' browsing and purchase history, as well as their interaction with the site to offer personalized product recommendations. By showing users products that align with their interests and preferences, the site increases the likelihood of users finding items they are interested in, thus prolonging the browsing session. Many online shopping sites use scarcity and urgency to drive engagement. They may offer limited-time deals, flash sales, or discounts with countdown timers to create a sense of urgency, encouraging users to make a purchase before the offer expires. Additionally, by allowing users to create wish lists or save items for later, shopping sites give users a reason to return to the site repeatedly. Users can keep track of the items they're interested in, and the site can send notifications or reminders when the prices drop or when items are running low in stock, further motivating users to complete their purchases. So what happens when companies employ these tactics? They create an addiction that can have serious consequences for users' mental health. The addictive nature of these tactics leads users to spend more time on social media platforms than they initially intended. As users get hooked on the constant flow of stimulating content, they may find themselves mindlessly scrolling for extended periods, leading to excessive screen time. This brings us to another issue that follows addictive design: the phenomenon of continuous partial attention. This term refers to the state of constantly dividing one's attention across multiple tasks or sources of information, often driven by the need to stay connected and updated in the digital world. Addictive design encourages users to consume a large amount of content in a short amount of time. The continuous stream of information can overload the brain, making it challenging to process and retain information effectively. The constant switching of attention between different tasks can impair memory consolidation and learning. The brain needs focused periods of concentration to encode information into long-term memory effectively, and continuous partial attention disrupts this process, making it difficult to retain information and apply it later. And now we'll be speaking with Dr. Joanna Strikers, who is an assistant professor of persuasive communication at the University of Amsterdam's School of Communication Research. Her research focuses on how insights gained from data can be used to adjust communication between organizations and consumers. She is also interested in how such data-driven communication impacts cognitions, attitudes, and behaviors of consumers related to their privacy, as well as what unintended effects such communication has on individuals and the society. All right, so welcome to our podcast. Before we start, could you state your name, pronouns, and tell us a little bit about yourself? How did you become interested in data-driven communication and consumer behavior?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Joanna Streikerts. And she, her, and I am an assistant professor of persuasive communication at the University of Amsterdam. I have been studying personalized communication, how companies use data, for quite some years until now. So I studied communication sciences for my undergrad and grad school and did a PhD in communication science and information law, when we focused on consumer empowerment and how consumers can be better empowered when it comes to how they share the data with big tech and how the data is being used. The funny thing is that when I started my PhD, it was actually a PhD on effectiveness of personalizing advertising to consumers. So the original aim, if you would look at the proposal from like years ago, was much more focused on like, how can the effectiveness of these ads be improved? And to what extent is this personalization, so like changing the ads to someone's behavior or personality, how can it improve like click-through rate, so how many things consumers click and all these kind of things. And then the more I was getting into it, the more I got into the like more activistic side kind of, so that instead of trying to improve the ads, let's try to improve how consumers are dealing with them. So it was like a process for me. And in the 4 years of my PhD, I've gotten from, okay, let's see what is possible to, okay, let's see how we make the playing field a bit more equal between the big tech and the consumers.
That is really impressive and sounds really interesting. I like how you detailed that sort of activism, starting on the side of the ads, then moving to the interest of consumers. Now, for listeners who may not be familiar with the term, could you please give an overview of what consumer exploitation is?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, if you look at, especially my specialty is advertising and commercial communication. So this idea of exploitation has existed. It's not new. It has existed since we have advertising. So there's always been this idea that like there is rather a thin line between what useful or rightful persuasion is versus where does it get into manipulation. And as this has been a discussion since basically ads exist. And there is, for example, in Europe where I work, there is a lot of laws about what are unfair commercial practices when it comes to advertising, when it comes to selling, and where do we draw the line. And now it became much more blurry since we have the digital communication and since our data is basically collected on a daily basis and it can be used to persuade you maybe in a more nuanced way for certain choices online. So that's where the risk for exploitation becomes much more relevant and much more interesting in the digital realm. So you could, for example, imagine that what happens very much is that consumers do not have much awareness on how their data is collected and how it can be used to influence them. So we have done a number of studies ourselves in the Netherlands and in Europe. There have been studies done in the US as well, showing that people are just not aware. It's very complex matter. Like for me, it's even difficult to follow. If you agree to things, if you click on accept online when you are signing up for things, or in Europe, you get a lot of cookie requests. So whenever a website you go to, it asks you, do you want cookies? I don't know how it is in the US, but probably on some website it also happens. And then you click accept and no one really knows what happens and what does it mean and what do they do with that. So that's like the first step for this risk for consumer exploitation. And then using that data that's often collected without like a real awareness and real consent, it can be decided by big tech platforms, for example, who gets included in information, in opportunities, in whatever they see online, right? So there have been cases, and that's been now a few years ago, that certain ethnic groups would not be exposed to job ads in certain contexts because they would be just excluded from the targeting. Or you wouldn't get ads or information about real estate in a certain area because of the kind of profiling, the group that you were put in based on your behavior or your demographic information. And then based on that, you would once never have seen the job. You never have seen the house that might be the house for you. So that's the first risk. Like, you just are excluded from very useful information for you that can exploit you in that way. And another risk that I am investigating and a lot of people are talking about is this idea of the digital space making it possible to exploit potential weaknesses in people. So you talked, for example, about addiction and digital addiction, and imagine that that's something that can be predicted, that you, for example, are really dependent on your phone. And if that information could be used to target you with certain items. So I know that the example given in this context very often is this idea, and that has been shown by some investigative journalists a few years ago, that from your scrolling patterns on social media, I imagine that you scroll very often randomly at 2-3 a.m. at night. And it's like, it seems like a doom scrolling, like someone just keeps scrolling their social media page. And you could make that link and assume that maybe that person cannot sleep, right? They might be in their bed. And I mean, that happens a lot. You have your phone next to you and you can't sleep. So you open it, you start scrolling Instagram or whatever. And based on that, the company could maybe show you advertising for some kind of sleeping aid, like all these paramedical pills that are supposed to help you fall asleep. And then the idea is that when it really happens at 2 a.m. when you're doom scrolling and you already can't sleep, you're more likely to be exploited, in the sense this insomnia can be actually exploited for you to buy that stuff. While you wake up the next morning, you think, hey, why did I buy this? Why did I spend $50 on this random thing? I would not do it, wasn't it for the fact that I was at 2 a.m. and I couldn't sleep. So that's kind of these examples of specific cases where the data that's collected about you can be directly used for exploiting your weaknesses. So that would be the second big risk that we are observing.
That was a really great answer. There's a lot of information packed in there. And just going over a couple points you mentioned, one about demographic information and how certain ads don't reach specific groups because they're not the target employees that companies want to hire. And two, about potential weaknesses and how digital spaces exploit those aspects for their own profit. I wanted to pivot back to that first point you mentioned about how certain groups might be excluded based on ethnicity, race, or gender, and how it affects the type of content they're exposed to. I was thinking from a youth perspective, if there are any impacts with educational or school opportunities, as well as internships or part-time jobs.
Yeah, I can imagine that happening, right? So we did this study a few years ago, and what we did in that, we asked a few hundred people in the Netherlands to install a tracker on their computer. So we basically did what the big tech does, but then hopefully for good. And it was following every single move they did online. And our aim was to see, okay, what are people seeing and how it differs between like different types of individuals. And what we, for example, found when it comes to gender and like this kind of stereotyping, that females saw significantly less content about high tech and generative technology compared to men. And I mean, like you would say, it's the same as it used to be, right? The magazines have always been like that, but now it gets like amplified. And it's not that I choose for it by buying a magazine. No, it's just the content I get served by my gender. So that was very interesting for us. We also saw the same thing happening with age, with elderly people being heavily targeted with certain health-related products. And because of probably their health status being lower, so they are more susceptible to it. So especially like for example, female students, that could be problematic, right? That you by default did not see certain opportunities. And I mean, there have been this very well-known cases when it comes to hiring, where women were disadvantaged in hiring process because of their profiles not matching the ideal profile, which was based on, let's say, 300 men who have worked at that company because they have been mostly men working there in the past. So that can get amplified again through this kind of algorithmic profiling and communication. So yeah, there's definitely risks in that.
I found that really interesting. I heard that a lot of the gender gap when hiring and doing interviews is lifted and that the gap is a little bit smaller. However, there are still instances where women or people of color are discriminated against in interviews just because they don't match that target description of what kind of employee a company wants. So could you go a little bit more in detail about how that might affect someone on a personal level, and also the effect it may have on the company?
So that was that's a very interesting question, because what happens with all any algorithm or AI driven solutions is that they are not biasing themselves, but they amplified existing biases in the society. So like with the stereotyping, it's not new that women get less information about tech or cars or whatever, and men are informed about it more. It has always been the case. So it would be the same with the hiring if there is already a bias, and that bias has existed. I mean, it's proven the gender gap is something that we know exists. It can get amplified by the algorithm. So there was this case a few years ago of this hiring algorithm, and I do not remember the name of the company right now, and it has been fixed, where the algorithm was trying to scan CVs based on existing CVs of existing employees to try to find a match for the company. Kind of makes sense. I mean, you know who works for you, they do a good job, you want someone similar. What happened, and just without anyone having any bad intentions, the algorithm picked up on the fact that many of these employees were members of some kind of fraternities and men clubs. I mean, because they just happened to have it on their CV. And then it was rejecting women just because they did not mention certain men's club or fraternities. And it was never any intention. So you can see that just simple mistakes or simple amplification of whatever is already happening. And then imagine that that impacts the company in the future, right? So if you do not have diverse teams, that's also something often talked about in tech. The diversity of a team that designs a tech helps to prevent these kind of mistakes, because you kind of can pick them up beforehand, right? So you have more people to think along and figure like, hey, maybe that will be a problem from perspective of me as a woman or a minority member. And then you get this vicious circle. Okay, so you don't hire them, so you don't have them on the team, so it gets worse again. So there is, it's kind of gets into this, into this non-stopping circles of amplifying biases.
Diversity is a great point to highlight. We discussed a little bit about AI and other conversations, but we haven't really touched on the topic of its use by companies and how it's used to evaluate interviews and resumes or CVs. Especially with the prevalence of artificial intelligence in consumer and company use, just as a resource or to more efficiently go through material, do you believe that some of these issues that are amplified by AI could be avoided if we instead used human interpreters?
So the problem of this, the biases often come from the existing data. So when it comes to the, for example I gave about not being included in job ads or in housing ads, it comes from the fact that in the past, the data showed that it happened less often that a certain type of individual, certain group of individuals were hired for such a job or bought a house in a certain area. And if we use AI in a very simple way, we will just repeat this all over and all over again. So the idea would be that a human could maybe avoid this. The question is, isn't that just a human nature? And that's a question that gets asked very often. And is it for real better? So, and I also think, like, when I look at the field of my work, so targeting or social media or by the big tech platforms on different in different online contexts, it is kind of unavoidable that these algorithms will be used. And I think the question now is mostly, what is the awareness among people that these type of tools or algorithms are being used? Do individuals that are affected by them in the very end, do they actually know how this works? And is it important for us that they know? Why would it be important that they know? So I think that's the questions that need to be answered first. And then the question, okay, so what is the oversight over these things? And that's where I think there is a big role for humans, that there is a good oversight. And if there is a wrongdoing that maybe was not predicted, that this is something that then gets prevented and that we learn from like existing mistakes. So I think I would not say like, hey, a human, just like, let's throw away all the AI developments and then like we have humans and it's perfect. But it's probably making sure that it's a conscious decision how these tools are used. I think that's like the bottom line, conscious decision by us, like the society as a whole.
I definitely agree, and it's very important to consider both sides of artificial intelligence and human intervention. Circling back to your initial answers on companies leveraging consumer data for their benefit, other than the more well-known techniques that websites and apps use to keep users engaged, like the infinite scroll, pull to refresh, or push notifications, are there other techniques that companies use that are more subtle and less noticeable, but still have an effect on consumer engagement?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I mean, there is a lot of different techniques that are generally called the dark patterns. And I don't know if you're familiar with the terms, but they are basically design principles in websites, or and design can be anything. So basically the content of a website or an app that are done so that they can influence consumer like in a kind of an aware way towards a certain behavior. And it can be the examples that you gave could be seen as instances of these dark patterns, but also many more. And one of them is, for example, certain instances of personalization. And the personalization is really, really central to all social media or like the big platforms that we are all using. And maybe it's not necessarily so interested in like us keeping scrolling, but indeed in the engagement and changing our behavior and how we interact with the platform. An example that you probably have heard about and has been mentioned in the media very often, has received a lot of attention, was this idea of personality targeting, let's say. So there are companies out there and scholars as well saying that based on the way you write your messages on social media, so or the way you post, let's say on Instagram, using certain algorithm, it can be analyzed to define what is your personality. Are you an extrovert? Are you an introvert? And based on that, such a company can know what triggers you, right? Something else triggers an extrovert versus something else triggers an introvert. And it has been shown in studies in the advertising research literature that actually matching, like if you're an extrovert and you see an image showing like a party and people dancing, that might be something that appeals to you. Versus when you are more an introvert and you see a more image that's stereotypically introvert, I know somebody in a book, I think that was they used in the study, they indeed show that the matching image appeals to you more and can drive your engagement with that content more because you feel more connection. So that's something much more like hidden, subtle, than these very, very straightforward techniques of scrolling or pulling to refresh that make it that change your behavior. Another thing that happens a lot and maybe also would change your engagement is trying to target or adjust the content you see to context. So context targeting, that's also one of the things that you would hear now a lot, especially in like the marketing world, where basically commercial content that a platform wants you to engage with will be very strongly adjusted to the context either you are seeing online or the physical context you are in. So think about location, think about maybe your situation at school, like what period is it at school and what kind of things are you dealing with? So making these context of your life matching with whatever you're seeing online would also drive your engagement. And that's much more effective than just matching it with like, let's say, I don't know, you search for something online and you see more of that, that's not going to drive engagement. But if you make it more about the situation you're in, that is much more effective.
That is very interesting that the algorithm is able to decipher such information, especially just from how you text, what you message, but also how you interact with the content. I also wanted to highlight what you said about personality targeting. What do you think is the success rate when using this sort of identification? Like, what do companies actually take away and learn about their users and consumers, other than their personality and presence on social media? And how may that affect their own companies?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's kind of still, I mean, this is a lot of research that's being in development, and there is a lot of quick developments going on right now, especially with like all this generative AI that I'm sure you heard about, and these new models that are much more powerful than they have been before. that can potentially be able to discover these things that, like, you as an individual don't really know that a company might know about you because you never shared it. I think the challenge there is that for a company especially, and I know that that's why many companies, if you talk to really an advertiser, and that meaning the company that really is behind the ad, so if it's Nike saying a Nike ad, if they would talk to the marketing people, they sometimes are maybe more skeptical, because you often don't know why a certain person will be categorized as a certain personality type or interest or whatnot. And that's something you want to be careful with. So you want to avoid putting people in boxes for the wrong reasons. So I think that's for companies is a very central point. And they do want to keep a good relation with their customers, right? So in the end, that's a balance between these new tools that have high promises and doing something that's okay with the customer and doing something that with the end user and doing something that's not going to lead to a backlash at the very end. So that's from the company perspective, I think, the challenge.
I want to zoom in on those consequences that companies have to face. Why do you think that companies continue to use addictive design and dark patterns in so many apps and websites even after they're called out? And do you think that collective action and awareness is enough to prevent digital addiction?
Yeah, that's a really good question, something I wonder myself sometimes. But I think there is the incentive to do so versus the consequences of doing so, or the negative consequence of doing so, are a bit out of balance right now. So we do not see, you see every now and then an article on the news about how bad it is that a certain company, the big tech platform, does something. Oh, that they collect this type of data, or that they use this kind of dark pattern. And then it's like a buzz for a little bit. What happened, for example, in Europe, what I thought was a very good example of this, was a WhatsApp I think by now it's probably a year or something ago, a year and a bit. They changed their privacy policy. And that was when Facebook, or Meta right now, bought WhatsApp. And they needed to adjust the privacy policy for the fact that basically they own a number of platforms. And it was some unclarities in this privacy policy, as far as I remember, about how the data sharing was going to happen between the different platforms and what kind of can WhatsApp. There was a lot of discussions here. Can your content of your WhatsApp messages, can they be used by Meta to like personalize ads on Facebook or like show you content on Facebook? Facebook was saying, of course, they're not going to do this, but there was a lot of doubts about it. And when they released that privacy policy update, there was a deadline on it. So if you did not agree by a certain date, you would not be able to use WhatsApp anymore. And a lot of people did not, like, kept clicking it away. People did not dare to say yes because of the media attention to it. I remember they extended the deadline at some point and said, okay, it was supposed to be like Monday, but a lot of people haven't done anything with it, so we extended. But in 2 weeks, you really, if you don't agree, you cannot use our services anymore. And I remember a lot of my friends installed like Telegram or Signal in those times. And you started getting messages from people like, hey, you should go on the alternative messaging app because they are so bad when it comes to their services, like terms of services, and they are not very transparent, and it's like Facebook now, so it's not good. And it was kind of like a move going on, and then it died. Like, and then in the end, I think everyone just accepted the WhatsApp privacy policy change. And the WhatsApp group stays on WhatsApp, and there were some people still on Telegram, but slowly, like, no one was using that anymore. So now I think everyone, like a year later, is back on the original platform. So even though there was this giant backlash, and even everyone has heard about it, and even though there actually was already move towards there, nothing happened. And I think that really showed like the core of the problem. So people were very resigned, feeling like, I can't do anything about it anyway. Like, if I don't say yes, they kick me out. And I'm really dependent on the platform. So I think like the resignation stemming from dependency, at least here in Europe, WhatsApp is like really, really widely used. And you use it for your friends, you use it for your work. So how are you going to find a good alternative? And then that's like the third thing that happens is the lack of alternatives. So even if the company does something like these dark patterns and they get called out on it and there's media attention and everyone says, yeah, it's really bad, but there's nowhere else you can go. So you're not going to change. So I think there is this combination of this resignation, this lack of alternatives, And this dependency on these platforms that we all have right now.
I don't know if you have you heard anything that's maybe similar to like a consumer's union, like people gathering to kind of like educate themselves to try and become more aware, but also engage with companies directly about some of their features and how they are treating their data and information.
So I'm not aware on the consumer really driven initiatives. So I know that, like, for example, in the Netherlands, we have a number of NGOs that are very strongly, they also involve consumers very strongly in it, especially when it comes to data collection and privacy. And they try to talk to the companies, and in case of the Europe, a lot of to the regulators, trying to find like, okay, where is the line for the consumer and where does it become bad for them? But it's very rare actually to see like some kind of collective action from the consumers themselves. And I think from a general, like from an average consumer perspective, also makes sense. So I've done a number of studies which are focused on informing consumers about these type of practices. So the one study we just focus on how personalization and all these targeting practices work with Google, and another one which was focused more generally of data collection from websites and how they track your behavior. And what was interesting from it is that at the end of the study, we just focused on trying to find effective ways to convey this information. At the end, we always had like an open question, like, is there anything else you would like to share with us? And we asked in total a few thousand adults in the Netherlands. And the interesting thing was that so many, I've never seen that before, so many left this comment at the end, thank you so much, I didn't know it was happening. Oh, wow, this is so insightful. So we saw that people really, even though they see it somehow in the media, they are not really aware of what exactly is happening. So I think that might also be part of the reason for lack of like collective action happening in there.
Anna, thank you. Back to Dietra.
Yeah, so I wanted to go back to that incident you talked about. And wanted to point out that I believe there was an update on TikTok maybe half or a full year ago where they changed their users' terms and conditions or privacy policy. And there was a sort of ultimatum between accepting those terms and conditions or being kicked off the app. And during that time, there were so many people talking about it, right? But even after the spur of attention and the creation of extra videos, there is that resignation and lack of alternatives that you underscored. So I was thinking that these sort of effects transcend communication apps and can also impact entertainment apps and websites. I wanted to ask whether these similarities are not only present in communication and entertainment apps, but if there are any other genres of resources that are affected by this sort of phenomenon.
Yeah, it's a very good question. I think actually this touches upon most of the large platforms or like digital services we are using. So, I mean, social media are one of the big things, right? So TikTok or other social media where there's just alternatives are very difficult. And I think all the apps that rely on kind of either having a lot of information there or everyone being there make it very difficult for you to find alternatives. So beyond social media, I think Google is a very good example of that as well. So every now and then you hear like an alternative search engine popping up, and then there is some attention to it, and then some people will switch. But then many would come back to the default they know and the one that they feel like they can rely on, because Google has, they feel, a lot of information, right? So if you look for something, you trust that they have a lot of that. So they have this kind of, it's even, you could call the monopoly position on certain, in certain sectors, that they basically monopolize the market. And I mean, there are actually discussions, especially in the US, about these companies being a monopoly and not having a fair competition, because they are just so large and they are such a default for individuals. And I think that's also maybe one more thing to mention when relating to your earlier question, when you ask about like, what are the tricks used by companies to keep you engaged with it. And I think defaults are also one of the big things in there. So we see defaults when it comes to data collection. People, it's much more difficult to change a setting when default is sharing data, but also default things like, is Google your default browser, or is WhatsApp your default messaging app? Those things that are like habits are just so difficult to break. So as soon as a platform or a digital service becomes a habit, it will become tricky to change that.
Right. All of the components of that sort of process sound really complicated. Going back to your initial statement on changes in privacy policies and consumer compliance, especially when we are considering geographical barriers around the world, like between us, the United States, and the Netherlands, what sorts of similarities and differences are found when comparing privacy policies and consumer safety? And are there any aspects that sort of stick out when sharing data in these respective regions?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think, I mean, there is really big differences, and I'm not a lawyer myself, but as far as I know, in the legal context of things. So Europe is very strongly focused on protection, and the European Union really tries to focus on consumer empowerment. So in Europe, we have a very unified privacy regulations. And an interesting thing is that they very strongly focus on what legal scholars would call the transparency of choice paradigm. So the idea is that an average European consumer should be an informed consumer who makes informed choices. So they should be informed about how the data is collected and processed, what is the purpose of it, so how is it going to be used to, for example, increase engagement with social media. And they also should be aware of many rights they have been given by the regulators here. So we have a right here to just say no to this. And there is also a right to ask companies to remove everything they know about you so that they cannot use that information for example, personalization or increasing engagement anymore. You also have a right here, for example, to ask a company for all your data and then tell them, okay, I don't want you to process it. I don't want you to have this data. I want to go with a different alternative or a different provider. So imagine there would be an alternative to TikTok. You could ask them, okay, TikTok, please take all the videos I have uploaded and give it to TikTok B, because now I want to use their service and I want them to have my information. So that's all the things that are available in Europe already to consumers, among many others, protection rules. And the difficulty with them is to what extent they are effective. So how many people actually have used these, and that stays low because of what we just discussed with this lack of alternatives, of this dependency and how difficult it is to use this. So while there is a strong focus on consumer empowerment here, you have much less effect of it. And Europe is also moving much more towards protecting consumers. So there is a new regulation that's coming up in the European Union that I think will, and they already have impact also beyond the European borders, where, for example, there's much more emphasis on transparency of these different practices, but not towards the consumer, but towards different oversight bodies. And one of them is, for example, researchers who should have access to how targeting happens on these big platforms, how, what kind of different information do individuals see, and how it is decided who sees what. So then me as a researcher would be able to look behind, kind of into the black box of whatever they are doing. And I think that's something that will help beyond European borders. And when it comes to the US, when you especially look at privacy regulations, I mean, they are much more fragmented. They are very specific laws that protect, for example, minors and children or information related to health. But then there is lack of these overarching frameworks. And we do see, we recently did a study which focused on a very specific phenomenon when it comes to data collection by platforms. So that was on this idea that a lot of people have, and I would guess that you would recognize that too, that sometimes when you pick up your phone and you open, and let's say TikTok or Instagram, you see an ad and it feels like the ad is directly related to what you've been just talking about with your friend or with your family. So you had a conversation, then you see an ad directly related to it. And a lot of people believe that phones have to be listening to them because there's no other way that this could be happening. And we try to figure, okay, so is this belief? And a lot of companies deny it. And there is not really ground truth. So, I mean, it is technically possible, but companies deny doing so. And we try to see, okay, so because of these different regulations in the US, when there's much less focus on this transparency versus Netherlands, when the transparency is like the thing, the king here, would people have different expectations here? And we did see that in the US, actually, the average adult was much more likely to believe that their phone was used to spy on them, listen to them, than in the Netherlands, when people actually expected, okay, that cannot be legal, right? That was the reaction you would get in the Netherlands. So you saw these different regulations actually impacting people's behavior when it comes to how they use digital media. So that definitely has a big impact.
You gave a lot of information about what sorts of policies we see in Europe and what patterns we see in the US. As members of the general public, we don't typically have that kind of digital education and literacy. And it feels like few people really know what kind of digital rights they have. I believe that the general goal of consumer awareness that's in Europe is also here in the US, but a lot of people, myself included, don't usually take the initiative to read those terms and conditions of an app or any of its changes just because of the legal terms and also having to go out of our way to read 12 pages of terms and conditions in a small font and on a small screen. So how can we ensure that people are aware of their user rights when navigating the internet?
That's a very good question. That's an extremely difficult question as well. So when I was doing my PhD, when I was doing the research, we tried to inform people in different ways about what happens online when it comes to their privacy. So what we tried was making some short videos that they could watch about either technical aspects of it or more legal aspects of it. And we tried to see what it does to them. And it was actually very difficult to make something that would be effective in informing them. So then I was a bit disappointed in this whole idea that the transparency can actually empower individuals and this information awareness can empower individuals. And later last year, the beginning of last year, we conducted a large study when we thought, okay, now we're going to test as many things as we can think of that theoretically could help individuals to make more informed decisions and be more aware. And in the end, we designed, as far as I remember from the top of my head, 9 different strategies that were based on 3 theoretical principles from science. And the interesting thing is that one thing actually worked out of the 9, worked well, and that was giving people training into something that's very simple and effective at the same time. So we focus in that case on tracking blockers, like a Ghost series, one of these plugins that you can install. And what we figure is that even if you train people and inform them, but the action to do something about it would have to happen on a daily basis. Like in Europe, it happens with these cookie pop-ups that you get pop up every time you visit the website. That just gets so tiring and gets just so frustrating and you get this fatigue from it, that's not going to work. So I think what seems to be working better is to indeed focusing on some simple and options that are there and providing specific training for them, that it's not just like a vague information. Maybe interesting to know as well, if we do studies and we ask people, to what extent do you think it's a problem? Like, do you believe this is even a problem that all these things happen? Of course, everyone thinks it's a problem. So if we ask them on a scale of 1 to 7, let's say how big of a problem it is, the average will be somewhere above 6. So it's not an issue that people do not notice the problem. The issue is that they often do not know what to do with it. So I think that's something we need to distinguish.
Wow, 9 different principles. That is a lot. Going back to the legal measures we discussed and adjusting our angle a little bit, are there any legal or regulatory measures put in place to protect consumers from exploitation by big businesses? And if so, do you believe that they are effective?
Yeah, so I think right now we indeed, at least in Europe here, and also in other countries or in other places, we see this strong focus on awareness, like we've discussed. And I think that's good, because it's good to make people aware of what's happening. But what you mentioned yourself, I mean, you don't read the 12 pages of privacy policy. I mean, who has time for that? And they are often written in a very difficult language. So I think the idea there is good. The implementation often goes wrong. Often these information right now is just too complex, too long, too hidden. And there is different initiatives right now, both legal and more technological, to help with it. So, for example, very interesting initiative that could be an alternative to explore is this idea of personal data vaults. This idea that you, instead of you having to make a lot of small decisions that are very difficult to follow, you have one personal vault somewhere with all your personal information in there, and you define beforehand, okay, so this is where my information is. And I'm gonna say, okay, if you are my bank, you can access obviously much more. But if you are a platform, this is only this bit that you can access about me. But you can much more in one time, you just set everything up, and you can obviously always change it. But you have this possibility to have this kind of data, your data protected and shared in an aware way. So I think it's very difficult to make it practically work, right? Because we get into the awareness issues again, but it could be an interesting alternative to explore to what we currently have. And I think making the, what we also see is that individuals often very strongly rely on the fact that regulations will protect them. So that was in a study we conducted in the Netherlands on the privacy regulations here. And what we saw is that people believed that, like, it's not their task, it's the task of the government to protect them. So they would behave a bit more maybe reckless or make share their data more freely because they feel like, okay, the really bad stuff is illegal. So I don't have so much to worry about. I mean, I have nothing to hide and I don't need to worry about it. People mostly worry about like cybercrime and these instances when they really get robbed from their money. That's something that we heard a lot of worries about. But the other things, like, I mean, it should be fine, right? There's laws for it. So I think that this reliance is very interesting. And then it might be something to explore in the future, and it is being explored right now in regulations here, to then let's say, okay, so it should be much clearer lines what's allowed and not when it comes to let's say targeting and data collection, and then certain practices which everyone agrees on are these dark patterns and are manipulative should be just straight out forbidden and companies should not engage with them. So that's another avenue you have for next to the transparency that we see now.
Okay, so taking into account those personal data vaults that you mentioned, are there any specific industries or sectors where consumer exploitation is particularly prevalent or have a spike? And why do you think that is the case?
Yeah, there's interesting thing has been when I did study on personalization, I think back in 2016. And for me, that was back then very surprising when I talked to companies asking, okay, so which sector is really good at this? Like, who does this well? They've always been mentioning gambling sector a lot. So I myself am not familiar with it, but apparently online gambling has always been very good in data collection and using it for engagement creation. And you saw it back recently in the Netherlands, where actually there has been a lot of attention to the gambling sector, specifically online gambling. And now gambling ads are actually forbidden. So you're not allowed to create engagement or with these kind of ads here. So I think that sector in Europe, that's really big in it. But another sector that maybe from the consumer perspective are very interesting is what consumers experience as sensitive context. So context matter there a lot. And when you talk to people about, okay, so what kind of data do you feel like strongly about, there have been studies showing that medical records are, of course, something that individuals feel very private about and they do not want it to be used or misused in any ways. And I think the more like health insurance companies and generally health related services move online, there will be something that will be very tricky. The same comes for finance sector. When you ask individuals what they worry a lot about, is often related to financial sector when it comes to how their credit card information could be used, how their financial information could be used and collected, because you feel strongly about it. So I think especially when it comes to these like vital services and the sensitive information, that's something that, for example, in such a vault would require extra attention and also requires extra legal attention in here.
All right, thank you for your answer. So wrapping up, how do you see the relationship between consumers and big tech companies evolving in the future? Will there be any significant changes in terms of consumer protection and the prevention of exploitation?
Yeah, I as a empowerment scholar, I would say I would hope that we see more empowerment for consumers and more level playing field. But I think what would be very interesting and what hopefully will happen, especially with these new regulations coming up in Europe, is maybe more alternatives for consumers, because I think that could really be a game changer if we have like meaningful alternatives to these services that we are using. And that would be something that I think would help a lot in the field. And another thing I think that we will be maybe seeing is more reflection on, like, this sector maybe has been a bit underregulated, or regulated is maybe the wrong word, but it has been exploring a lot what is possible and what is not possible, focusing on the technical possibilities. And I think maybe more reflection on what is desirable will also be visible. And I mean, years ago, when I already did interviews with big companies, they talked a lot about like ethical boards and things like that to kind of reflect on this. And I think that will be interesting. And you saw it recently, I think like a year ago, there's been a lot of attention to, let's say, cookie-less advertising. And that was like a really a buzzword, saying, okay, so do we really need to collect all this consumer data when consumers don't like it? Can we do this without cookies? And there were a number of, for example, Dutch publishers who make money from like creating engagement, right, with advertising, who said, like, we're going to just test if we could base the advertising you see simply on the article reading. So if you're reading about traveling, you get an ad for flight tickets. We don't need your data for it, but we can just do it based on whatever you are reading in real life. And that may be equally effective. So I think maybe just trying to find a balance between like high enthusiasm about technical possibilities versus what is really necessary and what really helps both the company and the consumer will hopefully be one of the other developments we will see.
Yeah, I just I also wanted to share, you know, some people have been reading the 12, or I think more people are starting to read the terms and conditions. And what happened recently, just maybe a month ago, was Zoom, which is actually headquartered and founded in San Jose. There was a tech blogger that read the terms and conditions and found a clause that said Zoom has the rights in perpetuity to use your chats, your voice, and recordings to train their AI. And they posted it, and then it went viral, and there was a huge backlash, and there was some back and forth, but eventually they actually removed that clause from their terms and conditions and said that we're not going to use your stuff to train AI. There's still some other problematic things in their terms and condition, but they did respond rather quickly.
Yeah, so I think, I mean, that's definitely like, right, something that will happen maybe hopefully more in the future. And you see that, like, it always feels a little bit to me like being a step behind in a way, because then someone finds something and then there is a backlash. But I think that might define new standards in the end.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. For our final question, I wanted to ask if there is anything we haven't talked about that you'd like to mention.
I think we've mentioned a lot of things already. And I think what's maybe good to like to sum this up is indeed like we, as a consumer as well, there is a lot of talks about privacy risks when it comes to like large platforms, but then it's good to realize the risks beyond privacy and what happens once the data is collected. So the data being collected is one thing, but what you are talking on the podcast about, like the digital addiction and possible exploitation, that's kind of a different risk that we shouldn't forget. So that would be something that I think is good to mention.
Okay, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day or night to speak with us. I learned so much from our conversation, and there was so much information, and it was really, really insightful. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me here.
Yes, thank you.
All right. So today we have explored how big businesses in Silicon Valley employ exploitation tactics to keep users engaged on their platforms. From push notifications to infinite scrolls, these features are designed to take advantage of our psychological tendencies. But how do we prevent becoming a victim ourselves? Establish clear boundaries for your technology usage. Customize your notification settings to receive only essential alerts. Assess the value and impact of each app on your well-being. And consider uninstalling or limiting your use of apps that you don't significantly use. Finally, changing your phone to grayscale is a practical and effective technique to reduce its visual appeal and curb excessive screen time. By switching to grayscale, these visuals lose their allure, making the phone less visually stimulating and reducing the impulse to check it frequently. As we end this episode, we can begin taking another step to reduce our digital dependency. we can establish device-free zones, times or areas in homes or workplaces where digital devices will not be used, such as right after you wake up or while you're studying, in order to minimize distractions and improve focus. Alternatively, you can establish an evening routine that involves disconnecting from digital devices an hour before bedtime to promote better sleep quality. Thanks so much for tuning in to this episode of our podcast.
Hi, I'm Rashmi, and I'll be leading you through a gentle body brushing practice today. So as you're ready, just finding a comfortable posture, and if you're able to, maybe standing today. Either way, taking a nice deep inhale through the nose, feeling the belly rise. Exhaling out of the nose. On your next inhale, bringing your shoulders up towards your ears, squeezing them in. Exhale, rounding them down the spine. If you're standing, go ahead and firmly press your feet into the floor, bending the knees. Continuing to take deep inhales through the nose, exhaling out of the mouth this time. Bringing both of the palms of the hands to the top of your head, and in swift, soft, and light movements, go ahead and start to brush the top of your head, the sides of your head, down the neck, shoulders, and arms, down the full front body, all the way down to your toes, making that same motion all the way up the back body. Imagining any negativity slowly falling away. Remembering to breathe here. And knowing that the earth can hold any grief, sadness, negative feelings or thoughts. The earth can hold any pain, any suffering. Giving it all to the earth and allowing the earth to hold it for you. Trusting the earth here. Taking a nice deep inhale through the nose. Exhaling out of the nose or mouth. Feel free to come back to this practice anytime throughout your day. Thank you so much for joining me today.